extra time is exactly how I find out what's going on in the MLS.
Get lost. Get lost.
Maybe this podcast has influenced me a little bit as well.
Everybody up here, every single day, goes into the office, into the laboratory, to try to cook up some great stuff for you guys.
That's why he's here.
Hey, everybody, welcome to Extra Time. I am not Andrew Ruby. You did not get an O from New York, New York. I'm David Goss, alongside Matt Flo for this one, as Weeby is on vacation. And I thought it was fitting to not do an O from New York, New York, because I believe that is a throwback ode to something about Allen Fieldhouse and Kansas basketball and some player from New York, which is obviously a dead entity being Kansas basketball. So I didn't want to delve into that road. You know what I mean, Doyle?
I know exactly what you mean. Well, I know what you mean. I don't know the factual accuracy of the statement, but we'll have to get Weeby to explain himself on a future episode of Extra Time.
I'm sure we can get a solid 7 to 14 minutes out of that for a segment, right?
We'll get a list out of it for sure.
We'll get a list out of it. Fantastic weekend of MLS action, wild weekend, plus a little international soccer that we'll discuss. Some incredible teenagers stepping onto the scene, some big time performances, some teams that bounce back that we will talk about. And then some teams that there are still worries. There are three teams in Major League Soccer that have yet to win a game so far in this regular season, and we are now into a match day 6. So it is starting to get a little worrying, as we've discussed over the last few weeks. So we'll dig into that a little bit more. Plus, the designated player makes his debut in a start for the Portland Timbers, but in a loss. We will have all of that coming up on this show. Doyle, your UConn Huskies are still alive. Your weekend was pretty good. I went to the game. It was one of the most boring sporting events I've ever been to. It was a tough doubleheader blowout to experience in Brooklyn, but I assume you had a good weekend.
I did have a good weekend. The first game was Duke versus James Madison, which was really disappointing. And then the second game was UConn versus Northwestern, which was that went how I think I thought it would go. It was fun, and it was a nice way to end the weekend. I did miss Sunday night MLS. We've had a lot of Sunday night MLS.
We've had a good spread schedule, and not this week.
Yeah, not this week. It was all on Saturday night. So that actually worked out okay for me, because I was able to watch UConn on Sunday, and I was able to watch the U.S. men's national team, which was actually a super enjoyable game as well. So no complaints. A good weekend.
Maria's in the chat right now. Disagreeing.
He had a less good weekend.
About the U.S.-Mexico. She said, I have lots of complaints that she would like to throw in here. Don't worry, we're going to talk about the Sounders having not won a game out as well. So Anders will also have a lot of complaints in the chat. So it'll be an active day for both of them. Let's start with the best thing you saw, though, on the weekend. And you want to talk about these teenagers that stepped into major roles in MLS.
Yeah, we're going to bring it back to our roots with the Play Your Kids.
Yep.
I think there were about 100 players, MLS players, on international duty this weekend. And then obviously there are a few injuries every weekend on top of that. So these match days give us the opportunity to go down the roster a little bit and see guys in bigger roles than they usually get. And in San Jose, that was the return of Nico Sakiris, who throughout his youth career, maybe more of a number 8 than a number 10. But for this weekend, and maybe for weekends to come, given how well he played, he was a number 10 for San Jose. He looked really good. 18-year-old U.S. youth international, eligible for next year's U-20 national team. I think he'll play a big role on that one. He was just really good, right? Like, he not goal dangerous yet, but he tilts the field. Every time he's on the ball, he's able to play progressively. I think he had, in 60 minutes, I think he had 15 passes into the final third, which is a pretty big number. Only created one chance, but was always getting Christian Espinoza in particular into dangerous spots. And it was just like a brand new Quakes team. So that was fun to see. And then, you know, if not for Lewis Morgan, maybe the player of the weekend was Fidel Barajas, 17-year-old Mexican-American from Sacramento. He played on the left side of what was kind of a traditional 4-4-2, and he's a left-footed playmaker. So he wasn't inverted or anything. It was kind of a throwback look, like 20-odd years. You don't actually see this formation with guys on their strong foot on the outside. But Barajas was great. And it, like, he lived up to his billing. He was the best playmaker in USL Championship last year. RSL did a good job of sort of beating other MLS teams to the punch, just like they did with Diego Luna, bringing him in and putting him in a position to be a difference maker. He had two assists. The first one, I mean, that is a hell of a pass, David.
Yeah, that's the pass that everyone thinks could be made and sort of has a half idea, but no one can complete it. Like, that pass gets cut out all the time.
Yeah.
And everyone sort of has an idea of, like, it's the only option unless he wants to turn around and drop the ball back, unless he wants to try and go to the end line and allow more players to get into it. And I think as he hits it, you, like, see the defenders being like, yep, we're going to clear this. And it just has eyes through everyone into Anderson Julio for the goal. And it was what we saw with Charleston last year, as you mentioned. He was the center of an attack that went to a USL Championship final at 16 years old. Like, this is even more than what Luna did with El Paso coming into this moment. And he's still a little bit younger.
Still a little bit younger. He's also a central, maybe the central piece of Mexico's youth national team system. Yeah,
he's been
at
the best
point.
Player in those groups.
He's born and raised in Sacramento, but he's Mexican American. And look, Mexico have recruited Mexican American players pretty hard over the past 10 years, given how much better broadly youth development is in the U.S. right now than it is in Mexico. I think we're going to see them recruiting dual nationals extremely hard over the next 10 years, because in Liga MX, the only team that is really consistently producing good players is Pachuca. That's it. There are 17 other, you know, top flight Liga MX teams, and most of them do not pay a lot of attention to their academy prospects or create that pipeline. And it's taken a toll on the national team. And that has been the talk of the past 12 hours in North American soccer, which I think is our segue to the best thing you saw this weekend.
I worry that if we go from yours to mine, that there's a chance we lose Maria forever in her reactions to all of it. But the best thing I saw this weekend was Tyler Adams. Not Major League Soccer specific, but a Major League Soccer guy. He was the first signing in Red Bull 2 history. We talked about it last week. He's the example of the pipeline. He was in the final residency class for the U.S. Youth National Team, which used to be a program down in Florida where the best young players lived with the U.S. U-17 National Team, because there weren't MLS academies or pro academies closer to home that they could play in. And the world has changed completely. And Tyler Adams is sort of the first generation of that. He was able to come home to the Red Bulls as a youth player captain, first signing for their 2 team, came through, won a championship with the 2 team, broke into the first team, became one of the best players on one of the best teams we've ever seen in MLS. And then he gets the big signing to go overseas. And now he is a central part of the national team. He struggled with injuries, which has been tough to watch, because he's a guy who wears his heart on his sleeve, and you can, like, feel it and you could hear it post game. Gio Reyna was, like, choked up for him in the post game press conference, talking about how much he loved him, how much he'd been through, how he understood so much of what Tyler had been through. I think it had been over 460 days since he had started a game for the national team, basically back to the World Cup. And he only had one goal in his career with the national team. It was against Mexico. He did it a second time against Mexico. This was a very Michael Bradley-esque of, like, I'm going to hit the nicest goal of my career in the biggest games against my biggest rival. And he takes the cover off the ball in a moment where he probably knows he's coming out, right? It's a 41st or 42nd minute. Mm-hmm. He's on a minute's limit. He got taken off after subbing on against Jamaica because he's on that limit. He started this game. He comes off at halftime. So, like, he kind of knows he's at his end, and he smacks the ball. I think Memo gets a bad sight at it, but he hits it so hard that then he can't recover. And then the celebration was just pure joy and energy. I was so happy for him. He is the easiest athlete to root for that I've been around. And it was great to see him back and do a big thing. And it kind of ties up all of what we're talking about of, like, how close these players can be in the pathway that's there for a lot of these guys.
Yeah, Berhalter. Look, the discussion after the U.S. have now beaten Mexico, what, five straight times in competitive games. I'm not counting friendlies here. I think they have a 490-minute shutout streak against El Tri in all competitive matches. It is as one-sided as this rivalry has been since the 80s. And, of course, in the 80s, it was one-sided in the other direction. Right. It's just the U.S. are just much better talent wise, much better tactically, much better pipeline than Mexico right now. And there was a lot of conversation in the post game from Mexican press and Mexican fans about what is the reason, what has gone wrong. And everybody has ideas, including producer Maria. And I think a lot of these ideas are correct. Like there is less incentive for managers in Liga MX to develop players because there's less job security. And if you are fighting for your job as a manager, you're probably going to play the 31-year-old and not the 17-year-old. And so the Liga MX compared to other leagues at, you know, in the next 14 is how it's called by FIFA designation, you know, MLS, Belgium, Portugal, Brazil, Argentina. Liga MX plays the fewest amount of young domestic players, gives them the fewest minutes. And that has a knock-on effect on the success of the national team. MLS, for what it's worth, is at or near the top of most of those metrics. Now, part of that is we have 29 teams, so that helps. But like it's just more opportunities to play. But the discussion is, why has the MLS or why has the U.S. national team moved so far ahead of El Tri? And a lot of it comes down to, well, they have more and better players in Europe. And that is true, right? The U.S., if you look at the starting line, I don't think a single guy who is in MLS currently played in that game. But Berhalter made the point that something like 75-80% of the guys who are in the U.S. national team pool played in MLS, or like Gio Reyna and Weston McKennie came through MLS academies. And that is something that Mexico is not doing right now. They are not producing the same volume of high-level prospects that we have seen come over the last 10 years from MLS academies, and it's only picking up steam. I mean, we're seeing Tom's reports and Fabrizio Romano's reports about Kevin Sullivan, who is, I mean, this is the, like, this kid is on, he's 14 years old. He's Quinn Sullivan's younger brother. Quinn Sullivan scored for the Union this weekend. He is unbelievable. Manchester City are after him. And because the Union have done such a good job of developing their players and becoming the type of academy that big clubs all over the world pay attention to, Kevin Sullivan now has his choice of Manchester City, Borussia Dortmund, Bayern Munich, Philadelphia Union, man. Any team in the world would be after this kid. Mexico, they're just not doing that. So it was an interesting and illustrative conversation after that game. And I just thought, you know, Berhalter's point of develop in a league that is a good level for you, dominate that league, and then move on. That's not happening for Mexican players right now, and they're paying the price every time they play the U.S.
It's an interesting conversation. I think there's a lot of different angles you can fall on. I fall somewhere in the middle of, like, I don't actually think a lot of these guys dominate MLS. It's that MLS is proactive about moving them on, because both these leagues are set up where, look at the top teams and the top players, and they're not from the two national team pools. That is still the case in Mexico, right? Like, look at Liga MX, and you're talking about teams that are built around foreign players. The Mexican players, the problem is that they stay in Liga MX and become passengers in a lot of the games, where right now we're seeing the American player pool go to Europe and push themselves into other teams because you're always going to sign, well, Leo Messi's an outlier, right? But you're always going to sign a Cucho if they're available.
Right.
Or a Giovinco, or as we'll talk about in a little bit, Raul Ruiz Diaz, right? Dennis Bouanga, like you're always going to sign those guys. And for the MLS, for the American players right now, rather than be the other guy on that team, they're going out and finding teams in other leagues where they're the guy at young ages. And then maybe we'll start to see players come back a la Georgi Mihailovic or Michael Bradley in the past, and maybe be centerpieces of teams where for a lot of the players in Mexico, it's you're just the other guy on the team, right? You just play. I mean, Tigres doesn't even play Mexican players, although they brought Flores and
he's Canadian.
Yeah, nice. And Diego Lainez back. But look at a lot of these. I mean, Quiñones now is available, but like he was the centerpiece of three of the last four championships in Liga MX. And you do the same now with Toluca and Cruz Azul and Monterrey going out and get Sergio Canales and building the team around him. So I think that's the miss right now is like once players break through, if there's not a spot there where they are pushing every week, and the game becomes a little bit easier because you need those domestic players in your team because of the rules, and but the team's not built around them and they're not being pushed. I think that's sort of where you start to see the problem, where credit to MLS teams right now, they're being proactive about pushing players into other leagues. They're letting players get that opportunity at really young ages. And I don't give credit for everything. Like there's right. still a million mistakes. I'm going to GA Cup next week. I'll get yelled at. I don't care. And I'm going to be in a bunch of debates and it's really fun. And there's a lot of people that are working really hard to continue to progress things and make things better. Not everything is perfect, but there seems to be a willingness. I think Fidel Barajas is an interesting case of like, did RSL beat teams to him, or did he look at Diego Luna and pass pieces and say like, this is a team that will do it for me. They'll right. give me the opportunity and then they will move me when the time is right. If you don't feel that way, you're not going to join the team. And it's a conversation we had about Christian Fletcher last year, mm-hmm. where after on the back of Kevin Paredes moving, they were able to convince him to finally come in to that academy and not try and go overseas as a 17-year-old on his own. So it's going to be interesting. These international weekends are always fun because these guys get chances and you see that first generation and then or next generation. And then who can hang on to spots? Because that's the question now is how does Barajas stay into the team? Sekiris should stay in the team because San Jose had yet to win a game and there aren't really other options. But if San Jose goes out and signs a DP10, where does his spot fall? And how does he now work his way into this team?
And that'll be the needle that they have to thread. But to bring it back to my original point, you used to be able to go 5 years, 10 years in MLS and not see a single teenage playmaker. And this past weekend we had two, and they were both excellent. And that bodes well for what's coming for this league.
Julian Hall made his debut at 15 on the season because it was before his bedtime finally for a game. So he was allowed to play in that game. If you want more on that, go to Tom Bogart at The Athletic. Of course, Tommy Scoops had all the stories on that one from a monsoon in New York, which did not stop Lewis Morgan. Can he do it on a rainy night in Harrison? The answer has always been yes. Doyle, apologize to me. I picked him as my dark horse MVP last year. I put him on my golden boot team. I was lambasted for 12 months. Apologize to me, and then you could apologize to Lewis Morgan.
All right. I will apologize to you. Lewis Morgan was awesome. It was still a terrible pick last year. And he's not going to be an MVP candidate. I know he's leading the golden boot race right now, but no, Lewis Morgan is not going to be an MVP. Now, comeback player of the year, I think he is a strong favorite to win that award. But of course he was able to do it on a rainy afternoon in Harrison. Scottish people are genetically engineered to perform
in marshes
in the rain. This was awesome. This was awesome to watch because the Red Bulls have changed. We're five games into the Sandro Schwartz era, and that's apparently how you're supposed to pronounce it, Schwartz, not Schwartz. I learned that from Kev Egan. We're five games into the Sandro Schwartz era, and it is very clear that is not the pure energy drink soccer murder ball that we've seen for most of the past decade. The Red Bulls, that first goal, I mean, that was tiki-taka. If you had put that, you know, if that was Messi finishing off a ball from Julian Gressel after a dummy from Luis Suarez, you'd have been like, yeah, that's exactly how that's supposed to look. Like, this was not the type of Red Bull soccer that we're used to seeing. They care about completing passes now. They do still care about winning 50-50s, but they're willing to drop their line a little bit more and give themselves space to run into, which was the story of the entire second half. In this one, they're completing passes out of the back. Their field tilt is not as significant as it was last year. Field tilt is the measure of the share of final third passes you hit, right? Like, there are two teams, you know, if each team hits 50 passes in the final third, then it's a 50-50 field tilt. The Red Bulls were second in the league last year behind Columbus in field tilt at about 59%. This year, they're right at 50%. That tells you they're not pressing as high. The other thing that tells us they're not pressing as high is passes per defensive action, which is a rough measure of how high and hard a team's press. The Red Bulls led the league last year, and they led the league 2 years ago and 3 years ago and 4 years ago. And every year since 2015, the Red Bulls have led the league in passes allowed per defensive action, usually with a number under 10. This year, they're like 22nd at about 13.5. DC United, with the old Red Bulls coach, lead the league in passes allowed per defensive action. So it's just I don't want to say entirely new, because they still have that high hectic press in the bag, and they still use it for slices of every game. And I think they used it well to start this game against a team that is going to try to play out of the back and maybe aren't good enough to do it, especially when they play in a three. But that is not all they are anymore. And it's paying dividends, man, because this was a huge bounce back win after they got thumped last week in Columbus. They ended this game before the hour mark. And honestly, even that feels a little bit generous to the visitors there. And they ended it with skill. And doing so with Lewis Morgan playing the central role and without Emil Forsberg, you know, like, this is it, it just feels like a new dawn for the entire club. And it certainly made them much more enjoyable to watch.
Without Forsberg, without Coronel, without Edelman, without Tolkien, there hasn't been a Red Bull group in 3 years that could win a game without their best guys. They were struggling to win these games with their best guys.
Yeah.
They had moved from the system covers talent and, like, we just recruit into the system, so therefore we don't have to spend money because the guys fit us, but they don't fit other teams. They had moved out of that into, like, there wasn't enough in the team to get results unless there was one or two people who put the team on their back. And there hasn't really been. Now, missing Lewis Morgan all of last year was massive for them. And now you bring in Forsberg, who's at a different level, but, like, I cannot think the last time you could roll a Red Bull team out there like this, with Wiki Carmona getting the one-off start, who's slowly developed, but fine. Now you've rotated center backs, even though Andres Reyes was the starter last year. Mira comes into goal. And I think Stroud's been really good this year.
Same.
For them. He's played in two different roles, more a little higher and deeper, but he cycles the ball. And when you talk about the tiki-taka, him and Amaya, they want the ball off their foot quickly. They're constantly moving. They are the right guys in that system. I'm excited for Amaya because this feels like what he should have been brought in to do, of, like, constantly keeping the ball moving, being able to charge forward when you realize a skip is on and you can make a play, and otherwise scrambling around and winning the ball and connecting the game for better attacking players in front of you and not having all of that attacking role fall on your shoulders. Van Zier, 4 assists. I believe so. He's the league leader in assists right now, and Lewis Morgan's the Golden Boot leader. That all probably sounds like a miracle to Red Bull fans. So this is really exciting. And also, I have to say, you're welcome to Lewis Morgan, because I didn't pick him for my Golden Boot team this year to lift that curse off of him. And now he's been able to go out and do these things. So you're welcome, Red Bull fans. Of course, you're welcome as well. I guess Miami won't be thanking me for this one. We've talked about Miami a bit, a non-messy game, missing a bunch of pieces. But you mentioned the mistakes out of the back. Aviles hands one over for one of the goals early on in this game. it feels like this is a tough matchup for Miami, but we also are getting into the space of like, without Messi, can they contend for a supporter shield and how often will he be available? Blah, blah, blah.
I mean, with or without Messi, it's pretty clear that we're going to have real concerns about that back line. And it's the onus is on Tata Martino to develop Tomas Avalis, who is the most expensive center back in league history, but is still a kid who can get in over his head real quick in these games. And we have seen that repeatedly. So Avalis had a stinker. Noah Allen had a stinker. The early season takeaway I have about this team is that whenever they play in a three instead of the 4-3-3, if they play the 3-5-2, they have just looked significantly more vulnerable. Getting an extra center back on the field has actually made them worse defensively. And I don't think we should see them in that lineup much anymore for the coming weeks. Even if Messi still needs another, you know, few weeks to rest that hamstring of his, push Julian Gressel up to right wing, put Robert Taylor at left wing, and rotate Campana and Suarez. And you have enough central midfielders, especially because Ben Hakramoski is going to be back imminently. And I thought David Ruiz in DC a week and a half ago, he was very good at right back. So you have the ability to stick with the 4-3-3. Even with all the absences, or even if Messi is going to be out for longer than I think we all expect. That's one. But two, like in Tata said it after the game, Red Bulls came into this game ready to win. We didn't even come in ready to compete. And I thought that was absolutely evident. And it doesn't matter how much talent you have. If you're not ready to compete, then you're going to lose.
The early underlying numbers for the Red Bulls are they've added all this attack by while maintaining the defense. Like, yes, they are still a top four or five defensive team. That's been their base the last few years. That's the formula for them. Like, that was the miracle they were hoping for. And they've done so far. Coaching, addition to talent, some players developing, getting a little more comfortable. I think Red Bull fans are pretty excited. We have in the rundown Supporters Shield MLS Cup question. Do you want to do that yet, or do you want to wait a little bit longer?
So I said at the start of the year that I could see this team being a shield threat because I think they're going to continue to be very good defensively. And I thought Forsberg, just the addition of him, he would upgrade their attack. Forsberg and a healthy Lewis Morgan. Even if they don't go out and get a DP number nine, this team still has the pieces to go out and win the shield. What they don't have is enough quality in the box, I don't think, to win MLS Cup. Like, how many teams ever win MLS Cup without an elite number nine?
Seattle in 2016.
There you go.
I was just going back through them. Yeah.
It happened once almost a decade ago. And if you go back, you know, before that, Fernando Adi in 2015, he was an elite number nine in the league. 2014 was Robbie Keane and Jossie Zardes. 2013, Dom Dwyer had his breakout season. You know, 2012, Robbie Keane and Landon Donovan. 2011, Robbie Keane and Landon Donovan. You know, you need that guy. The Red Bulls, if they are serious about winning MLS Cup finally, they will go out and get that guy. And I know for a fact that they were close on a number nine, who would have been young DP number nine a little over a month ago. Didn't happen. I don't think that they're going to try to push that across the finish line before this winter window closes. But in July, when the summer window opens, they will have a DP slot to work with. And given what we've seen from this team, given that Sandro Schwartz is not cheap as a head coach, and that Emil Forsberg behind the scenes is already pushing for more reinforcements, I would be surprised if the Red Bulls don't add another big piece to this roster.
Well, for their fans who have been through some stuff over the last few years, I think for that event where everyone thought Messi was coming, everyone's tuned in, for your team to play that soccer, I think is pretty fun, pretty exciting. So congrats to them. Let's move into our big headlines. Let's start with LAFC, the bounce back. They won MLS Cup with Chicho Arango as their center forward, who's pretty good. He's not on the team anymore. They don't really like center forwards anymore, but they finally broke a 305-minute scoreless streak with five goals in one game against Nashville in a 5-0 win. Denny Bouanga gets back on the board, gets back into his flow, which is great for, I don't know, some competition I have with Anders that he changes the rules or the line on every single time it comes up. My question for you is, do you believe in this performance? Was this okay, they had a goal-scoring drought, and this is who they are, or was this a flash in the pan?
Yeah, I mean, this was an outlier performance. I believe that LA, I think I had LAFC fourth or fifth in the West, and I still think that that's roughly where they are. They have been snake-bit in front of goal coming into this game, and maybe this is what they needed to get them untracked, but it's not going to be as easy for them, even if they do add Olivier Giroud. It's not going to be as easy for them as it was on this game. But, you know, Nashville just didn't have anything in this one.
And they needed confidence. They needed a bounce back. Bouanga has missed chances. He scores. So, like, if that alone fixes this, of he gets his confidence back, he feels comfortable, he feels good, and then he gets back into his flow, that's probably enough for LAFC to take from this game and say, okay, at least we can play through him. Because if you have him at the level he was at last year, you are not good enough to be that top team. You still need Giroud. And as you said, you probably need a little bit more, but you are different than the team you've been over this first month of the season. And that's enough to keep them afloat, because you look at this group, like, the floor is pretty high. The back line is fairly strong. Central midfield is strong. They don't have a ton of guys. They lose for internationals clearly from this weekend. And so they're going to be consistent week in and week out. It's just all on that goal scoring. And it's all on a lot of my frog. It's all on a lot of young guys besides Bouanga. And so it falls on him, a big game from him. Is there a worry for you from Nashville? Because I look at this and say they're missing Walker Zimmerman. They're missing Anibal Godoy, who defensively has been every bit as important as Zimmerman over the course of the last few, or over the course of their entire existence. They're missing McNaughton for this one. They give up the first goal on a set piece, which is a problem for them, as it has always been. And then I think a weird penalty kick, and you're down 2-0 at LAFC. They probably lose this game 3-0 last year, is my point. They lost it 5-0 this year. Is that a huge worry for you that this is a different group?
Yeah, it is. I don't think... So the way Nashville have been so effective over the years is by defending deep and hitting on the counter. Now, they have had, at times, the ability to play in different sort of formats while still using that as the main foundational principle. And a big part of the reason it was so effective is that Walker Zimmerman was unspeakably dominant defending in his own 18. So why would you not play to his strengths as a defender? And then on top of that, you had Godoy and Dax McCarty in a double pivot in front of the back line. And by the way, I don't mean to minimize, Dave Romney was good for years. And I think both McNaughton and Jack Mayer were very good last year, good young players. None of them at Zimmerman's level. It was built around Zimmerman. And then Godoy and Dax in front of them in a double pivot, both of these guys phenomenal at winning second balls and then playing quickly and accurately to feet in pockets. And Godoy, well, Dax more than Godoy in that first one, and Godoy in particular, his ability to switch the field of play. And that was like, the entire game model, if people focus on Hani, and I understand why, he's been spectacular in the open field, but like to get in the open field in the first place, the foundational pieces were Zimmerman's dominance in the box, Dax and Godoy, their varying abilities to get you into transition, win the ball, and play quickly. Dax is gone. Zimmerman is now into his 30s and is pretty frequently absent. We still don't know exactly when he's going to return from this latest surgery, because Nashville aren't super forthcoming about that. Godoy.
And if he does, he might be at Copa America immediately.
Correct. And Godoy is showing his age. He's into his mid-30s now. The foundational pieces of the game model aren't what they once were. And so you have a team that is being forced to actually evolve and maybe don't want to. You know, Gary Smith is going back to his time, with Colorado. He was never a coach who preached front foot attacking soccer, right? It was always absorb and counter and built around dominant center backs. And they're really not that team right now. And so they've had good moments. Like I think the previous two games for Nashville were pretty promising as they were trying to be a little bit more expansive in the way they used the ball. And then this week, without Zimmerman, without Godoy, and up against an LAFC team that had a lot to play for, they were very, very bad. And it's jarring because this level of up and down in results is the antithesis of what Nashville have been. The way they played meant that they were never going to get blown out. I think they have, coming into the season, I think they lost two games ever by three or more goals. You know, like that across all competitions. That's absurd. So you can see it changing. And it just goes to show, like, guys like Walker Zimmerman are not a dime a dozen, man. And we saw LAFC's defense fall apart when they traded him to Nashville in the first place 5 years ago. And we're seeing Nashville now struggle to figure out how to defend without him. And I think it's going to change the entire way they play. And over the past 21 games across all competitions, going to the end of Leagues Cup, I think they have only 5 wins and Hani's got only 3 goals. It's been pretty dark.
Yeah, and it's interesting because they've tried. Mm-hmm. Like, they drafted Jack Merritt at the same way Walker Zimmerman was brought into this league. The Sean Davis signing was trying to preempt Dax and Annabelle Godoy's decline. This year, the Drew Yearwood trade, which I think was a little bit more risky, but maybe that shows sort of the panic that they had internally going into this year. And then, of course, bringing in Sam Surge and Tyler Boyd as well. The idea was, okay, maybe we can add more to the attack to try and cover some of the things, because the underlying numbers are with the goals given up. Like, they are one of the worst defensive teams in the league this year. It is not just like crazy finishes and flash in the pan moments. And this week was with Mayer back because he's been out a little bit as well. Okay. Mm-hmm. You could understand how many guys down are you. I think he's better than Lucas McNaughton. So I think of the two, that's who you choose to have in there. And they brought Brent Coleman in as like a steady MLS guy who's played in this league, and they still got blown off the field. So I think it, on the one hand, I don't worry. I'm trying not to worry too much yet if I'm Nashville, because you have a model that you believe in. You don't have the pieces there. But on the other hand, you're right. Of a lot of the core of those pieces are outliers in what they do great, and they are on the wrong side of 30, and this might be the end. And Surridge with Hani and Boyd and all of them have not gelled or been on the field enough to make a difference in the other direction. Because we've seen some teams in this league take a half step back in what they're great at and a large step forward in what they weren't good at, and be able to continue to move forward or shift. We've seen Seattle do it over the last 10 years, and we've seen other groups do that. LAFC, you could even argue, going to MLS Cup last year, is a completely different team than the one that went to MLS Cup 2 years before that, and the one that won Supporters Shield 2 years before that. But Nashville right now, they don't have a strength. So they don't have anything to rely on. And as you said, the range in performances is scary, because they were a team where you could say dog days of summer, things go up and down, travel, internationals. Nashville's going to grind out enough results that they'll be in a playoff conversation. And then it's whether or not they can peek into that. And right now, they don't feel like that team.
And the other part of it, I agree 100%. The other part of it is, they have to go out and buy nearly finished products, because they just don't develop a lot of players. Like, they've gotten more out of Jacob Schaffelberg than I expected them to, but he's not a starter in MLS. Mayer is a
He's a Copa America player.
There you go.
Congratulations to Canada. We forgot to lead with that.
You know, Mayer is he's a probably a starting caliber. Probably a starting caliber center back in MLS, but not definitely, and certainly not definitely on a championship worthy team. And those are the, in 5 years, those are the two big developmental wins. So yeah. You're limited in what you can expect from young players, which means you have to shop for older players, more proven players, and those guys are pricey. And that sort of puts a hard cap on what you can do if you're, or what you can expect if you're a Nashville fan.
All right. So for Nashville, the question is, do we believe it? Do we not? Let's go to a team that everyone believes they want to watch, which is the LA Galaxy, a 3-2 win, come from behind against SKC. We'll talk about SKC foils in a second, but this Galaxy team, this is your season pass team, right? This is your, if they're playing, it's got to be on the main screen because you're guaranteed at least chaos and goals.
Correct.
That's all I get. That's your version of excitement.
Like the chaos comes from the things that we have come to expect out of the Galaxy the past 7-8 years, right? Disorganization, can't defend in their box, are disastrous sometimes defending set pieces. They were in this game, certainly. Then the goals come from it feels almost like a Garth Lagerwey team, where Garth puts together a team where it's high level pieces in attack and they all fit together. So it works really, really well. And that is what we're seeing from the Galaxy so far, a month into the season. They finally gave Ricky Pudge a couple of wingers who run, and that has their strengths resonate with his strength as a central genius, central playmaker. And that in turn has elevated the play of Dejan Jovalich, who has 5 goals in 5 games, second player in MLS history to start the season with a goal in each of the first 5 games, joining Brian McBride, pretty good company. And he's just a classic number 9. And because he does the classic number 9 stuff, that creates a positive feedback loop. So the opposing center backs have to stay a little tighter, which means that the, you know, Paintsil and Gabriel Peck, who I thought was pretty decent in this one, they have more room to run into, and they have the chance to go 1v1 more often, and they're getting the ball in space and in high leverage positions. And because of that, fullbacks on both sides are able to get up and get into the attack. And when they get into the attack, they have room to combine instead of just settling for low percentage crosses. And because they're not settling for low percentage crosses, they're not seeing clearances up the middle that Pooch was never going to win. And that leads to fewer counterattacks that they have to deal with going in the other direction. So it's all a positive feedback loop. I am bullish on the Galaxy. I think we saw why.
You're bullish on them being fun or them being good?
Both.
Okay.
What I am not bullish on is them winning a trophy, because they are still poor defending in their own box. And they are, and look, they Ricky Pudge is, he's a MVP caliber player in this. Well, if not for Messi, he'd be an MVP caliber player in this league. He still will break his own team's shape to get the ball. And when they do, we saw it 2 weeks ago against St. Louis, when he breaks the Galaxy's shape to get the ball needlessly, they become exponentially more vulnerable. So they have to coach that out of him somehow, some way. If he does that, yeah, I still can't see a team that's this iffy defending in their own box winning a trophy, but I could see them getting real close and playing a lot of fun games and putting the fear of God into somebody.
They defend poorly in their own box. They also clearly don't react to restarts well, because SKC took everything quick, and their two goals came from quick restarts, corner kicks, throw-ins. It just kept being a problem. But as you talked about, the things that are going well are working. I like that with Peck out there, Payne still can come inside more and he looks comfortable there while Peck hangs outside, where for the first few weeks it was Fagundes coming inside more and Payne still hanging out wide and being that threat. So there's options. I think there's a lot of creativity from that flow, and with Jovalić as that go-to forward, everyone kind of has that point to work off of, which has been really fun to watch. I think Brugman will be a big difference for them in a lot of ways. One being maybe Ricky gets more confident in his passing in Brugman's than his other teammates and sort of feels like he doesn't have to go and make the game at all times, which would help you get a little bit more structured as you go along. For Jovalić, you talked about the record he's sitting on the edge of, which would be starting the season 5 games, 5 goals in a row. Do you have him in your Golden Boot conversation already? Because he hasn't been efficient, but he has scored 1 million goals.
He has been efficient at finding chances.
Mm-hmm.
And I trust guys who find chances to keep scoring goals. I think as long as Ricky and one of the wingers stay healthy, then Jovalić is going to be in the Golden Boot race for the entire season. And that's what you want. You want the Galaxy aren't doing anything super complicated in attack. They're not using a false nine to rearrange the opposite. No, they're just generating chances by being really great on the ball and really aggressive in stretching the field. And you just want a number nine to do the job. And I think Jovalić is that exact type of center forward. And I don't see a reason why he's going to stop scoring.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. I think he is going to continue to score a ton of goals because they're going to continue to create a ton of chances. They have to win games. He's in a really good spot. Did any of us take him on our Golden Boot team?
I think Tom might have him.
Ugh.
Yeah.
We should just deal with Tom's team in private when he's not around. We should just all pick it apart. We can create an alliance, and then we can all pick what we want out of it, and then we could just tell him, sorry, we thought you were invited to the meeting where you were going to give everyone the players on your team. For SKC, I go back to a similar convo with Nashville. Is this a moment of madness or is this their weakness? It happened so fast. The 3 goals are in an 8-minute span after being up 2-0 from 72nd, I think it was, to the 80th. That has happened to good soccer teams in the past, which is all of a sudden the rock's rolling down the hill faster than you're ready for. And it's the results already done before everyone wakes up and figures it out. On the other side, this is an SKC team that's had weaknesses in the past. Saying they're missing Fontas would never have been a comment about struggling defensively in the past, but that is one thing to throw out there. They probably could have put this game away at 3-0, but that wouldn't take away the issues they have defensively. So do you come out of this one with huge worry for SKC?
I will say 1 loss from 5, 6 goals allowed in those 5 games. KC are more vulnerable and playing worse soccer than I thought they would be at this point in the season, given what they looked like the final 2/3 of last year and into the playoffs. But given the talent level on this team and the consistency they've shown in figuring it out, I'm not out on Sporting Kansas City, but I am more worried than I expected to be about them at the end of March.
I still don't feel like I know because of how weird their schedule has been. They had Houston, who were in CONCACAF and have 1 million injuries. They had Philly, who were in CONCACAF. They played at LAFC, which felt like a great result, but that's in the span of over 400 minutes without scoring a goal. And then they beat San Jose and now this Galaxy game. So I don't know that I've seen them at their best, but they also haven't been fully healthy themselves. They also might not be. I should probably accept that of over the last 2 years, the reality of a team built on some of the aging stars they have in Russell and Pulido and Walter and
Fontas.
Amelia. Yeah, exactly. And also clearly these guys' profiles, which is a lot of these players are injury prone and they already lost in Debe for the year. So,
and also they played a 4-2-3-1 in this. With Pulido dropping in and Willy Agata leading the line, and you don't see Peter Vermees change that formation basically at all.
And you wouldn't think you'd see it with Pulido healthy. You thought the outlier would be, okay, we don't have Pulido, let's move things around and see if we can find some gaps. Pulido's a great playmaker. But I think part of what makes him great is he's a great playmaker for a center forward.
Right. He's not a
similar to Muriel of what we've seen where he's kind of been stuck as a second forward. It's like he's good at it, but he's great when it's his secondary attribute and not the reason he's on the field.
Right.
I had SKC second in the West coming into the year, so I should probably be a little bit more worried, but I'm going to choose not to be. Where is your worry on the Philadelphia Union? We said it was must win. We said they were in trouble. There was all this pressure, all these worries last week. They go to Portland. They go down a goal. They win 3-1. Does that settle everything for you?
It doesn't settle.
Carranza settled my team, by my Golden Boot team, by the way.
Yeah, it doesn't settle everything for me. That was their first win in league play. They looked terrible against Pachuca in CONCACAF Champions Cup. I still think this is a team in a certain amount of flux, but it did feel like the old version of the Union where it almost didn't matter who you threw out there. They were going to be bought in and they're going to run through a wall for the badge. And it helps when you have that level of commitment from your best player. And 2 years ago, last year, we would have said the best player is Andre Blake or Jakub Glesnes or maybe Ale Bedoya. Julian Carranza is the best player on the Union, and it's by a mile. He is that guy right now, and I think throughout the rest of the year. And if he's going to play like that, the Union are going to continue to win games. The question is, A, health, and B, happiness, because there's been a ton of talk over the years about will he be sold to team X, Y, and Z? What happens if the summer comes and he's not? And then the other fly in the ointment, you know, I saw someone at, and Tom has a lot of information. I saw someone ask Tom maybe a month ago who come the summer transfer window, who is Julian Carranza going to be playing for? And Tom's answer was another team in MLS.
That would be the wildest way for this to end.
It really would.
At his age and profile and not being an American player where you're like, okay, as a domestic, it makes sense. Like that would be wild, but it would also at that point mean that Philly hasn't gotten any offers. And we saw with Kai Wagner, they tried. Mm-hmm. And they could not get an offer that was in anyone's realm of possibility. And if that's the case with Carranza as well, then whatever you're getting in allocation money goes straight into your team, and that might make more sense for them. It would be worrying for a lot of reasons, the biggest one being Ua cannot score a goal.
Right.
He had two or three chances again in this game. He had an assist, right? He affects the game. He's a part of what is good for them, but that's when Carranza's out there, and that's when Bedoya's out there, and that's when Jose Martinez and Jack McGlynn are out there. He is not a guy to carry anything for them. And it wouldn't feel like there's a lot in this group already. They'd have to go out and get someone. And I don't know where they're going because we haven't historically seen them do that or do that well outside the league. That would be mind-blowing. Whew, you just gave me chills right there for a second. It won't be the Portland Timbers, though. Yep. They got their DP center forward, Jonathan Rodriguez. He made his debut. He scored. I think he hit the post as well in this one. Early assessment on him and maybe Portland now with him
as advertised. He's a true number nine. He's always going to be around the ball in the box. He's always going to find chances. I like this move. I think they spent a reported $4 million for him, which seems like a lot for a 30-year-old, but this guy, if he stays healthy, he's a 15 goal scorer for each of the next 3 years. And that is like just plug and play. He's a super honest presence defensively as well. I think it was a good move. I expect him to continue to find chances and to score. Phil Neville was not happy with his team's mentality. That's what he focused on after the game. I think that's okay. Like that it feels like a little bit of coach speak to me. What I would be focused on is the gaps between the back line and midfield, especially. Just rewatching that game, there was always maybe 5 or 10 yards too much space between Portland's lines. And look, the Union without Jack McGlynn and without Daniel Gazdag, it's not like they loaded up the field with a ton of great playmakers, but you give any good pro 5 or 10 yards more space than they should have, you're going to end up picking the ball out of your net. And it happened 3 times.
Yeah, center back's been a question for this team for a while. Kamal Miller's an ad. I don't know that McGraw or Zuparic is, like you talked about Jack Mayer, I think they're in like that conversation right now. Zuparic going downhill. With Kamal Miller, I think it's reasonable. Without him, it seems a little bit tough. Maybe that's where they try and add some more pieces as they go along. For Toronto, there's huge question marks about what their summer will look like. It may have taken a curve, unfortunately, early on. They get the win. But Lorenzo Insigne comes off right before halftime, I believe it was, with a hamstring injury. John Herdman said they do an MRI on Sunday, so we're still waiting to hear on that. If he is out, what does it mean for this team that's been one of the early stories of the 2024 season?
I mean, it doesn't seem like something they're equipped to deal with, right? Because so much of what we've seen from them to start the year has been defend resolutely and hope that Insigne can conjure up a golazo, and it's gotten them 2 wins.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure what plan B is. Now, we may have seen a little bit of that in this game with Bernardeschi. Instead of playing as a wing back, he came inside. He played as a code number 10. Jonathan Osorio's back. You could drop him as a code number 10 as well. And Jaquiel Marshall-Ruddy finally starting to develop. You play him as a right wing back, and Tyrese Spicer, the number one super draft pick, he got his first goal. You play him as a left wing back. I could see that working in attack to a degree, but it's still this is a team cobbled together under 3 different coaches and 2 different GMs and maybe 2 or 3 different roster-building approaches and strategies. And it's worth noting that there have been 0 significant expenditures since Bernardeschi and Insigne were brought in. So I don't think in years past we would have said, oh, yeah, they can shop their way out of this one. Yeah.
I mean, this was the team that brought in, I can't even remember the names now, but like random Spanish DPs at the end of the transfer window just to fill a hole to see if it could get them over the line. And now we're talking about pretty much having an open one because Osorio is a low-end one, Insigne getting hurt and being like, there's not going to be any more talent in this roster.
Yeah. So it doesn't bode well. I also think that, we're going to – John Herdman, everyone who I've spoken with who's played for him has raved about his ability to get – buy-in from the locker room. But that is going to be tested in the coming weeks without your star player. And it's just going to be different between being a national team head coach, which is all he's ever been until taking this job, and being a club team head coach. And if it wears thin just even a little bit, then we're going to see the results and the performances start to take a nosedive. And look, the underlying numbers are already flashing kind of a red alert. This team has overperformed what would be expected from them so far in this season, because they have a guy who could conjure a match winner out of nothing. Again, Insigne did it twice.
Pablo Piatti, who was talking about Argentine, but came from Spain. So I apologize to the Piatti family and everyone else involved for my snafu. As you said, it could get bad. It's been exciting. It's been fun. They've been one of the stories, I think, not just on the field, off the field, though. It feels like it's been built around Insigne, right? The whole culture thing feels like, for Herdman, started with Insigne. And so when you talk about the locker room, like if he's not there, it feels like that's where Herdman started, which is the right thing. Win him over. Let him bring the team to you. Let him lead the team. If he's not there, are the other guys on board? Do the other guys really know what you're trying to build and how you're trying to do it, as well as taking his talent off the field, which has been as seminal for any team in one player as there's been in Major League Soccer so far this year. So 2-0 win over Atlanta. I thought it was their most solid performance.
Agreed.
I thought the variance of this performance was the lowest. DeAndre Kerr comes back. I thought he was a good add. Mabika has played fine in this league. He stepped in. He played okay. So it feels like the project is progressing, but this could be a huge bump in there, and something I'm sure all Toronto fans are going to be keeping an eye on as we go forward. Let's get into That's Whack, because Andrew Ruby's not here, and now we have to do this. I have zero energy for the title of this segment and saying that phrase as many times as he does. So that's the one you're going to get, and now we're going to go and do it, which meant Anders had to bring the juice for me on what goes in here. He had two proposals. One was the Houston Dynamo scoring off what probably was a foul against Maxu on a counterattack in the 96th minute of a game with zero chances. Brad Smith getting that goal. And then the just pure chaos of the Charlotte-Columbus game. You had two injuries for Columbus in the first half. The goal taken off, an early red card, and then the two late goals. It's hard to say anything's whack when Patrick Aujamon gets a goal the way he did. He's Rhode Island owned or Connecticut's owned? He's Connecticut born, Rhode Island college.
So Connecticut born, went to play at Eastern Connecticut State University in Division III for a couple of years. And
ECSD.
Then the ECSU. And then went to URI for a couple of years.
Right. So all the good spots, all of our favorite places, he's involved. So it's hard to say that. Do you want to pick one of these? Do you have a strong feeling about any of it?
I want you to pick.
I'll take Houston, because I think the Columbus thing was on its own and whatever chaos. I don't know if whack's the right term. I'll take the Houston Colorado one. This was a tough one in terms of like all the pieces that are missing. We still have no idea with Ace Ace for Houston. And I thought for Colorado, I had seen half steps over these games. Like I was taking small victories out of ties and losses. And this didn't feel like any of that. No energy to push the game, whether in possession or out of possession. Georgie has not clicked in that role. I get you're missing Connor Ronan, and that's massive for them. It's like he's the only one who does what he does. But Houston at home with the injuries they've had and the pieces they're missing, this felt like a spot to like get yourself right, get a result, and then build off that. And that was not the case at all.
Correct. I just can't add anything to that. It's just like it doesn't appear to be working for Colorado. And you just have to give Ben Olsen and Houston so much credit. You talk about a culture builder, getting the level of buy-in he's gotten from Ace Ace and now continuing to get with Ace Ace out. We didn't see last year coming. We didn't see this year coming either. It's been really impressive.
You don't want to overstate a goal, but like Brad Smith was a big time player for the Sounders. He has been in some big trades. He has started for Australia. He's a backup winger right now.
Yeah.
Coming to this league as a fullback. I think that goes into a little bit of like what guys are willing to do and the way they're willing to try and fit in. So Houston grinds out another result. They're going to have to keep doing that until they're able to bring some more pieces in to try and fill in for all the injuries that they have. Let's finish you on this one. A low one, but we'll go there anyway. The New England Revolution failed to win once again. So they are one of the three teams without a win. San Jose finally got their victory and that come from behind against Seattle. Wait, we never even did that game.
No, we didn't. We
I totally went over. Let's talk about San Jose coming from behind.
Not a fan of San Jose. Playing against them, they are playing very dirty football, and I don't think they deserve points ever.
All right, that was elite from Anders. None of that was planned. The fact that he had that ready to go so quickly, tip the cap to you, credit. San Jose comes from behind because they let Seattle come back from behind. They scored a minute after Seattle equalized at 2-2 at home. Jeremy Obobese came off the bench to score that goal. We talked about Nico Tsikaris. So we talked about what he brought in a little bit. But for San Jose, this was a huge moment, a huge relief for the coach, for Jeremy Obobese, I think, for Christian Espinoza to finally get a goal. And I think this whole team to finally be able to take a breath.
Yeah, and just to correct the record, San Jose had a 2-0 lead. And then Seattle came from behind during the tactics free zone, the final 20 minutes, to tie it 2-2. And then a minute after Danny Musovski had tied it 2-2, Obobese got what proved to be the game winner. San Jose looked good. I'm not sure how much to read into it, because a lot of that was, I think, Seattle looking bad. And Seattle, look, Brian Schmetzer's strength as a head coach, the thing that has made him one of the best and most successful coaches in MLS history, is that he just plugs the right players into the right positions in the right formation week after week after week. And that has disappeared over the past month. And what we have seen instead is Seattle playing a 4-4-2 with Jordan Morris and Raul Ruiz Diaz up top. And those guys have negative chemistry when they're playing as forwards together. If you put Morris out on the wing and Raul Ruiz Diaz as a center forward, then things tend to work pretty well. We have a lot of data that confirms that. Even with Albert Rusnak back, though he didn't start, but still, the Sounders have enough pieces to continue to play a 4-2-3-1. They haven't done it this year. And that gives teams space in central midfield. And so Seattle are not controlling games where on the field they're played or the tempo they're played at like they did last year. And that was the foundational piece of everything that this team is. And it's gone away. And when it goes away, you have games where you give up three goals to a team that had not been even remotely threatening for most of the season. So well done to San Jose. It was good to see Securus back. I think he can be a force magnifier, if not necessarily a match winner. But I'm unsure as I don't know how much to read into it, because Seattle are so uncharacteristically soft and ragged through midfield.
Let's end on a high note, because I'm the positive one, and based off the email we got where I'm the golden retriever of the group, which I'll take compared to, I don't know, you're the dog with the droopy ears and Weeby is some other, Weeby is like a raven or a crow that sits above and garners a negative energy sometimes with what he wants to talk about. Raul Ruiz Diaz, in all the negativity, scored his 80th career Seattle Sounders goal. That sets the club record for all-time career goals for Seattle. He was signed back in 2018. It was when Clint Dempsey had retired, but it really was trying to replace Obafemi Martins with Nelson Valdez wasn't able to do, except for that short run when they won MLS Cup. They won an MLS Cup without taking a shot on goal. It was the attack that they needed to improve. He came in. He came in, I think, as a different type of signing than what we had seen. It was sort of what Seattle did with Nico Ladero as well. And he won an MLS Cup. He went to two MLS Cups. But the biggest one probably is that they won the first CCL for an MLS club ever. And he was a huge part of all of that. He's a fantastic player. He's been a fantastic signing. And it's great to see him back. He is not who he was, but he looks sharper than he did last year. He looks more active. You talked about the formation. I think a lot of that is falling on the goals for him and some of the performance. But at least he looks like he's going to be able to finish his career on a strong note, unlike what we saw last year. And he's just been a perfect signing for Seattle over the last 6 years.
Yeah, I mean, he's been one of the best number nine signings in league history. And I still think that he's a guy who will get 12, 13 goals this year if they just go back to the team they were in 2023. And getting Albert Rusnak back, I assume he will start this coming weekend. Getting João Paulo back, he is starting to train. So I think that he'll be probably 2 or 3 weeks. Once they get those guys on the field in their spots, I still expect it to click for Seattle. And it wouldn't shock me if Raul Ruiz Diaz wins the number nine job, because he's still just a better center forward than either Jordan Morris or Danny Musasi. Good players, but Raul Ruiz Diaz, even at 34 years old, he's a guy I would count on to find some goals.
He is a guy that a lot of people have tried to replicate in MLS, of like trying to go to Liga MX and find that number nine, find a younger number nine that you can build around for a couple of years. He's had some big moments. He has 9 career playoff goals. He was Espria's Mr. October because he doesn't do it any other part of the season. But Rui Diaz was a big game player, and that's what you want for your number nine in the biggest moments, to step up and to lead you, scored the big penalty in this one as well, which at the time looked like it was going to get them a result. So big result for this San Jose team. Big result for a number of teams this weekend trying to right themselves. And we've got a big week coming up as well. U.S. national team, as I said, still the only team to ever win a CONCACAF Nations League on the men's side. History continues. Congrats to Canada. Congrats to Lewis Morgan for me not picking him on my Golden Boot team and for him being able to bounce back. Andrew Wiebe will still be out on Thursday. He's back on the vacation run, as we talked about all of last year. It's what he does best. So I'll be back with you. We'll have an assortment of guests, maybe some old hosts coming back in, a lot to talk to. So enjoy the rest of your week, and we'll talk to you again soon.